Hi, this is Wade with Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. Excited to be here in the studio, also known as my office here today, with a guest who will be familiar to some of our listeners, Dr. Mark Brown. Mark, thank you for joining us today.
Good to be here.
And we're also joined by Ben, who took the time after an unfortunate Packer-Viking game to show up and join us. And Mike, who is becoming a familiar voice. Mike, would you like to say hello?
Hello.
We are missing Peter, though. I don't know if he decided he needed to skip out because the Vikings won, and he's celebrating. In addition, they also injured Aaron Rodgers. He was wearing a Viking jersey when I did see him for a little bit today. I also heard they did arrest a jaywalker in Wauwatosa. The community is pretty broken up about that. Some sort of therapy dog counseling sessions are being offered, and so he may have taken his family to that. Today we're going to be talking about a very interesting and fun paper that Mark Brown, that Mark has written, and he'll give background about it a little bit later in the episode, Black Geneva Piety. And it really will be exploring some interesting history of liturgical vestments and the liturgy itself, and the Synodical Conference attitudes towards that, and especially within the Wells. The more full title is An Analysis of the Changing View of the Relationship of Doctrine and Liturgy Within the Wells. And so with that, we will get into our episode, making our way first with the scripture narrative. Scripture narrative, which is taken from one verse from Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2, if you're familiar with the Acts of the Apostles, is where we learn about the festival of Pentecost that we celebrate each church year as the Holy Spirit comes and people prophesy in tongues, and then Peter gets up to preach and gives a thoroughly Lutheran sermon, and people are cut to the heart and are repentant and will be baptized. With numbers that every pastor who's ever preached since has only coveted week after week, perhaps to the disappointment of no baptisms that Sunday, let alone thousands after his sermon. But we hear then what happens after this Pentecost day, this major festival of the Christian church year, as what do the believers do? Now there's all these new believers, what are they going to do? And Acts chapter 2, verse 42, Luke simply tells us, "And they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers." And so we see them gathering for worship, gathering for divine service, whatever someone might want to call it, God's service. And we're given these details, but we are not given an agenda. We're not told what they were wearing, which way they were facing, what exactly they said in every instance. Probably much of what they were doing was following along a general order or things that they had inherited from synagogue worship. But about ever since that time, there have been debates or thoughts or even disputes about how the Christian church, how churches should celebrate the divine service, the worship service, whatever you might call it in your background, what we should do when we come together. Now, we see here already, and we see throughout the New Testament early on, there's two things that are going to be very important, which is going to be the preaching of the word of law and gospel. And really, this is the task of the Christian church throughout the world. And then secondarily, the administration of the sacraments, not secondarily, as though they are less important, but just that they go with the preaching. The sacraments themselves, which are preaching in a way too, as the Lord gives us words to proclaim as he works through water or bread and wine to give the forgiveness of sins and life and salvation. And so how that plays out, what that's looked like in different times in church history has varied. And today we'll be talking about what it looked like in our little Midwestern neck of the woods, but I guess throughout the states for the churches of what was called the Synodical Conference, which, Mark, you can correct me if I'm wrong, would have been the Wisconsin Synod, Missouri Synod, Evangelical Lutheran Synod, and the Slovak Synod. Is that all four of them?
Yeah, at least since 1920. There were six originally, but there were some reshufflings
okay.
back at the beginning.
And so what did it look like, especially for Missouri and the Wisconsin Synod as we go through? If we refer to Wisconsin and Missouri, we're simply talking about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. We'll be getting into that. But as we do so, I don't know what your thoughts, experiences, preferences might be, but at the end of the day, we all hopefully will fall back on that the task that is given to the church is that preaching of law and gospel of Christ Jesus crucified for sinners and the sacraments rightly administered as we are put to death in baptism and raised to new life, and as we receive Christ's body and blood for forgiveness, life, and salvation in the Lord's Supper. And so delighting in that forgiveness of sins and that new life that is given to us, we can then get into the stuff of what should we surround those events with. And that will then take us to our free-for-all.
All right, welcome back. We are going to enter a free-for-all, and coming off an embarrassing, terrible loss by the United States national men's team in soccer, World Cup qualifying, in which they eliminated themselves from the 2018 Russian-held hosted World Cup, we decided, since this is our favorite sport, that we need a new team to cheer on in Russia in 2018. So we're going to go around, and everybody's got to pick a team. Now, we have some of the qualifiers before us, so we actually know who plays soccer. And there's still some qualifying going on still, but these are the main teams. So, Ben, you're up first. Who are you going to cheer for in this upcoming World Cup?
Well, let me start by saying I saw a great meme about U.S. soccer. It said, it had a picture of the American flag, and then it said, when you're so bad at football that you create your own game called football that nobody else plays so that you can be the best at football. And I think that sums things up nicely. We'll probably be, if any of you are real soccer fans, we apologize for our ignorance on this subject. Looking at the teams and the little I do know, I'm going to say I think Germany's going to win. I don't know that I'll be rooting for them actively or that I have any affinity to them over anybody else that's on this list, but I think they've got a pretty strong team. Argentina will be fun to watch, too, because from what I understand, they're very good, but they only have one player who can do anything, and if it's all up to him, that's Messi. A lot of people say the best player in the world. So I'll be interested in seeing Argentina do well. I think one of their last qualifying games, they were down like 1-0, and then Messi scored a hat trick to put them up and win. So kind of a one-man show.
All right, Wade, you can't pick Germany.
All right, well, I'm just going to chime in and say, A, since this is a Russian-held World Cup, I'm still not sure that the United States has actually been disqualified. I think Congress should look into fake news, tampering, things of that nature.
Also, the Ukraine has been technically eliminated. We're not sure about that one either.
Yeah, I think their players get to play for Russia now.
There's a big sure. Facebook campaign to get the U.S. team not to qualify or something. I heard something about that.
Yeah, I think it really did undermine their efforts. They were disheartened with all the news they had read and just went in expecting...
So that's Mark Zuckerberg's fault that the U.S. team isn't in the World Cup, if any of you are wondering.
I think the U.S. men's national team will actually be writing a book now, too, in which they will explain who all's fault it was for them not qualifying. And I'm going to have to say the teams I normally would have said, the U.S. and the Netherlands, have been disqualified. So that takes that away. And I printed off an article for us to use, and it seems to be very Eurocentric. So there's a lot of teams that are not on our radar. It's nothing against them. It's just I apparently printed an article that didn't have all of them. So looking at the list, if I'm not allowed to say Germany, which is absolutely what I would have said next, I'm going to go, it says that Croatia can still play in. And so I am going to go with, I would like Croatia to play in and somehow be in the championship against Serbia, which is qualified. And it could be like a nonviolent reliving of the 90s tensions, a healthy way to work out whatever differences may still exist. It says here of Serbia, they're winners of Group B, Spain. So I don't know if Group B could play against G if it
Those are the European ones, so they'll be reshuffled.
All right. Well, I'm going to go with Croatia then, because I've been to Croatia, and it was really affordable beer. And Carlo Vacco, good beer. And I went with a friend of the show, John Bordelon. And so it was a fun time. Got to meet his relatives. So I'm going to go with Croatia.
Wait, you said this was a European-centric list. I'm noticing that, too. I don't even see, like, the Dallas Cowboys in here or anything. So maybe we should get a better source.
I will say I think I am going to get into the World Cup. As of today, the NFC North for American football, which I won't say real football or not, whatever, but it's just a mess. Aaron Rodgers injured. Vikings managed to win, but not convincingly. The Lions are just terrible. Bears got a win, and it was a big deal because the Bears got a win. So I think NFL is just, there's not much to watch
this
year.
It would seem like the one team for whom nothing has changed is the Bears. I mean, they're still where they were before.
Yeah.
But the others, it's more interesting now.
And I do want to correct my earlier prediction of the Packers going 12-4. I'm going to change it to 4-12 now.
So would you say Rodgers is, you were talking about Messi in Argentina,
he's
the Messi of...
I will be the first to admit as a fan that they rely on a one-man show a little bit.
So we've got Croatia, we've got Argentina. Mike, did you share your pick?
Not yet. I'm on the same lines of you, I'm hoping that Ireland and Northern Ireland that are still alive will somehow make it and come to the final there. That would be impressive.
What if that were to happen and then like halfway through the game England just shows up and claims to have won?
That would be perfect.
Or maybe England shows up and they don't claim they've won. England just shows up and says they get to decide what the score is and who wins.
Maybe Bono could write some kind of a song to commemorate the event.
You too. Theme song.
When I was in Ireland with a bunch of future Lutheran pastors, we were stuck in Ireland because the trains weren't working, and so we were at a pub, and they found out that we were Lutheran pastors, or they asked, some of the locals asked what we were doing there and who we are and stuff like that, and we said we were Lutheran pastors, and they said, shh, I wouldn't say that too loud. So half joking, but you know, kind of half not joking too. So, Mark, who you got in the World Cup?
Well, he is wearing green. I'll point out.
I've got green on. Yeah, I'm so sad that Moldova and what was the other one, Latvia, are both not in contention. I just like the sound of those names. I knew a little Latvian girl at one of our grade schools that was she was more of a friend to my son, I think, than he was always to her. But I feel completely unqualified to talk about this. There was an episode of Cheers many years ago, of course, where the bar had a lottery going on the games pool, and Diane was winning, and she would pick the teams in terms of the state flowers that she liked. She had absolutely no idea about football, and I just really don't know much about soccer, but I'm partial to Ireland because my wife and I spent a week there this last summer, and such a pleasant place to be, and we inadvertently got caught up in the horse race one day in Killarney, which is a really interesting experience, somewhat like being at the Kentucky Derby here.
Oh, cool.
We didn't get to see the race. We got caught in the crowd afterwards, and they're such a small country, you know. The numbers are low, and if they can compete, good for them. And everybody I asked about Northern Ireland, they said, yeah, great place to visit, gone back, you know. So
nice.
I think a lot of the tensions have lessened, from what I can tell, which just tells you nothing.
Unless
about
they end up
soccer.
Playing each other, probably.
Well, this could reignite it, yeah.
Garbage cans on fire. And
yeah, yeah.
I will say, looking at this list, if we had to pick who we think is going to win, you guys...
Germany.
Yeah, I'm going to say Germany, too.
Germany or Spain.
And Mark, you don't...
Not Argentina. Isn't Argentina the one with a great individual player?
Messi,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can't one guy do it?
I don't know.
Could happen.
I think someone had a great quote. I can't remember who said it last time Germany played Argentina. Was you had the one country that should feel guilty and the other country that... if you have a German last name and you're rooting for, you should feel guilty. So that would be a fun matchup too. That wasn't Argentina where they caught Eichmann back in the day.
Could be. That is back in the day. I remember that as a grade school kid. I think it was Argentina.
I could be wrong.
Well, Michael, a lot of German immigrants in Uruguay, Paraguay, and Argentina. We don't know that history.
Probably was like I'm guessing like mid 1940s. There was like a lovely travel magazine article about the beaches or whatever. the beef. I don't know.
The beef would help. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Mike, anything else on that, or should we make our way to something
we actually know about? We have fully exhausted all of our soccer knowledge. So
I think it's going to ultimately come down to the play of the middlemen. Is that a thing, the middlemen or midfielders?
Midfielders?
No. I'm going to say it's going to come down to the play of the midfielders for whatever team wins.
Special teams. It's always special teams that wins, wins the championship.
Is there 11 players in soccer?
There are.
So I'm going to say there's the 12th man, the crowd.
Yes.
Is going to factor in as well.
So, and but they don't have a penalty box like hockey, do they?
No, they have a yellow card and a red card.
Where do you go when you get the red card? Do you just go back to the bench, or do you have to? Are you ejected?
I don't know the answer to that. I know you're. I mean, it's different in different tournaments and things. Like if you just miss that game, or you miss another game after it, and then you can get like a yellow card. But if you get two in a game, you're out. But if you get two games in the same round, you miss the next game, but you get to stay in the game you're in currently. It's
you know,
very
where I bet
strange.
In this World Cup, you know where I bet you go if you get a red card?
Gulag.
The Gulag.
I was going to say Siberia, but I like Gulag is a good answer too. All right. Well, I think we've exhausted that. Mike, is it okay with you if we make our way on?
I think so.
Our main topic for today, which is Dr. Brown's paper, The Black Geneva Piety of the Wisconsin Synod, an analysis of the changing view of the relationship of doctrine and liturgy within the Wells. And so maybe, Mark, as you get us started, you could give us a little bit of background, or however much you're willing to share, of how the paper kind of came to be and how you've gone about, how you went about approaching it.
Yeah, I think really the roots of it go back to when I was working on my dissertation research, and I tried to get into the American Lutheran, which was a phenomenon which never really happened in the Wisconsin Synod, but it happened in the Missouri Synod, that there were interest groups that organized around certain viewpoints. And the American Lutheran Publicity Bureau was a group back during World War I that wanted to help the Missouri Synod churches present themselves better to the general public at a time when it wasn't getting to be so cool to be German anymore. And so I had read through issues of the American Lutheran magazine, which was their publication, started in 1918. And there was a lot of interest in the 1920s and 30s about improving worship. But that really wasn't too much a part of my dissertation. But then there was a question that I asked on my, I did a survey with 8 questions, and I got a very high percentage of responses from Wells pastors, most of whom have passed away since then, who lived through this. And the question that I asked that got this response was, what was it that you saw about Missouri that, in your minds, said something's changing here? And among all the many other answers was one answer by an individual who said, well, they started becoming more doctrinally, more liturgically high church. And as we all know, that is a sure indicator of doctrinal drift. I'm not quoting him exactly. And that showed how really the paradigm had shifted, because that was what I grew up with. There were a couple of guys in the 1960s, early 70s, who left our seminary and went to the ALC or wherever, and we assumed that, you know, we saw them with their smells and bells, and, you know, we assumed that their doctrine was also more liberal. But by the 90s, this had changed around. And so one reader, a pastor, read this and said, I can't hardly believe this, because being liturgically high church, I don't like that term, but liturgically aware and active is no indicator of this at all. So he asked me, you know, to say some more about this. And that led me to go back into the development of this in the American Lutheran, and how Missouri was involved in the liturgical movements in the 1930s, and how Wisconsin resisted it. And of course, this history was very close to the ground, because I talk about a little bit of a furor that happened at Watertown in the 1970s, and one very anti-liturgical innovations of any kind person who complained about the beribboned dandies that would get on stage and trot around in the liturgical finery. He was my roommate. So, I mean, I heard about this all the time. And how Wisconsin moved over to become probably what we would say more historically in line with the Lutheran history, not the pietist history that we experienced, but the sense that Lutheranism would keep everything in the Church Catholic that they didn't disagree with, and how really I think the fulcrum of this whole story of change at Mequon was Professor Tiefel, that there were people who were liturgically more interested before him. There are still some after him who are not. There's the whole sort of evangelical type of style that's popular among some Wells pastors and churches. But he was the person, and I think Professor Tiefel was a little bit uncomfortable with reading this, but yet the evidence was overwhelming. And again, it was people's perceptions of this. This is kind of a gossipy paper in its own way. So I was asked to give it in the Michigan district, which was, you know, I felt a little bit dangerous to begin with. This is Western Conference, though.
Now, these are my people, though.
I know, but I mean, I used to be in that district, and I don't know if I'm a favorite son or not. But I gave it there for a pastor's conference and provoked a fair amount of conversation. And then I bulked up the paper with more research, and then presented it at the Lutheran Historical Conference in South Carolina that fall, which has no other Wisconsin Synod members except Joel Pless and very few other Missouri. And of course, they really don't know us at all. So almost everything about us is kind of novel to them.
Now they must really like us. They must really like us now after reading the paper.
No, I think we're... Well, I don't want to get into that. That's another whole broadcast entirely.
Mark mentioned maybe just a little bit on Wisconsin Synod, kind of administrative, how it's broken up. So we have the Wisconsin Synod, which Synod, right, is a church body that's supposed to be walking together, is where the word comes from. And we're broken into districts. If I remember, we have 12 districts. Mm-hmm. Does that sound correct?
That's right.
And so... oftentimes, the different districts have their different personalities or things of that nature. The Missouri Synod as well, then, is broken into districts. I have no idea how many, but I know it's more than us. And then, what is it?
I think it's 36.
30. You can just say that in the mic instead
of
holding
your fingers. I think it's 36.
Out. Very good. And whereas I believe the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is broken into synods instead of districts, which can be confusing then when we talk about Missouri Synod or Wisconsin Synod.
Well, and the ELCA, I believe, actually has a Wisconsin Synod. So yeah. I heard a story on the radio about a pastor in Madison that got into some kind of trouble, and they said he was a Wisconsin Synod pastor in the Lutheran or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and I was all confused when I heard that. But I believe there's a Wisconsin Synod.
That
well,
would make sense. That's
true. And there's another incident which even was somewhat more striking, is that, you know, the ELCA headquarters is in Chicago, but for a brief time there was consideration of Milwaukee as the headquarters.
Really?
And that really confused one local newsman who stood in front of the Wells Administration Building on Mayfair Road and said, told the 10 o'clock news that this possibly could become the center of the ELCA, and had everybody confused, and I think he had to fix his story pretty quickly. I think Milwaukee was too far off the path for people to fly in from wherever, because you can come to O'Hare and get over to ELCA headquarters in 10 minutes and go back. But at any rate, Missouri has its many districts, and they had, I would say that their districts even today seem to have more of district-wide reputations than Wisconsin does.
Senate-wide reputations?
Yeah. That you say, well, you know, that's the Nebraska district or that's Indiana. I think Indiana is an especially explosive area because you've got Fort Wayne and you've got Valparaiso in the same.
Well, and then I think they have the what they call the saltwater districts, right, where the more you are towards either ocean, the reputation at least tends to be less conservative or traditional.
But what Missouri also had and still has is the English district, which was a non-geographical district. And, of course, its initial reason for existence, to the best of my knowledge, was to encourage English worship. So right there, you would have a group of people who were probably more progressive about some issues. And there are several churches in Milwaukee that were English district churches. And there were Wisconsin Synod churches in Milwaukee in the teens and 20s that wanted to do English worship. But, you know, the pastors were a little bit reluctant because they weren't so sure their English was good. They didn't want to embarrass themselves. But the English Synod was primarily associated with the eastern part of the United States, New York and that area. And that area has, well, it's still true today with Pastor Behnke's involvement with the Yankee Stadium. There's always this sense that that district and that area was more progressive. And so when the American Lutheran Publicity Bureau started, they were saying, we've got to present ourselves better to Americans. We are too German. We are too immigrant. Our worship services are sloppy. There's a part of the paper where I cite a number of the things that people complain about in the churches, and it's almost humorous to read. The awful music, the dirty church buildings, the buildings are dark inside, you know, the
torn organs, hymnals, I think.
Torn hymnals, the organs plays like she's playing with her elbows. You know, this is just sloppy. And so there was a lot of really helpful stuff in there, and they really developed quite a large mailing list. But by the middle 1930s, the American Lutheran Publicity Bureau had gathered more progressive voices, and I think people like Theodore Grebner and others, and they were encouraging Missouri to be in fellowship with the ALC. So their original plan was to say, look, we agree with the doctrine, but we want to change some of the culture and the worship practices. 20 years later, they were evidence of a doctrinal differentiation. Now,
just briefly, Mark, the ALC would have been the American Lutheran Church, which eventually would merge with the LCA. Was that Lutheran Church in America?
No. The ALC actually formed in 1930, and it was a Midwestern church, largely German-based church, made up of the old Buffalo, Iowa, and Ohio synods. Now, you know that we came razor close, the Synodical Conference, to coming into fellowship with them in 1930. And when actually Missouri voted no first in 1929, those three formed the ALC.
Okay.
But the American Lutheran Church, the ALC, was always more in the middle of the road, and the LCA, the Lutheran Church in America, was more Eastern, went back to colonial times in more cases, and had been more Americanized. You know, there was some who kind of liked what Schmucker did and things
Revivalists,
like that.
Revivalists, yeah.
Yeah, so I've always felt that in the reshuffling of the synods in the 1970s, it was the American Lutheran Church, the ALC, that was kind of the loser in this because they had the middle position, and that middle position kind of got swallowed up by the ELCA.
So the ALCA, together with the LCA and some other churches, became the ELCA, or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, eventually. And so what you're saying is the ALC, the American Lutheran Church, was the more conservative or grounded from a confessional perspective of those churches, but ends up just somewhat being swallowed up or immersed in the more progressive thought or practice of other church bodies.
Yeah, and I think you could draw a straight line from the American Lutheran Publicity Bureau to Lutheran Forum and to people that ended up in Seminex. And then when the ELCA is being put together, probably the most unpredictable and in some cases radical voices came out of the Missouri group, the group that was formed in the ALC and left the Missouri Synod, the AELC. I mean, listen to Dr. Scare talk about this, and he will say they were the ones that brought the most dissident ideas, let's say. And so there is this sense that the people that were concerned about issues in the old American Lutheran Publicity Bureau moved to go beyond those issues into other things in doctrine. And as you know, there's someone writing a history about this now, and he's actually come back to me and asked for help because I've saved all this stuff. And I did confront him at the 2014 conference here, and I say, well, so aren't you really saying that a group that starts out saying, look, we're not challenging the doctrine of the church body, we're just saying we should try to change some of our culture, isn't your history saying that 20 years later they will be challenging the doctrine? And I had in mind somewhat what might happen with Church and Change, who are saying, look, we believe Wells doctrine, we just want to change some things in the culture, what might happen 20 years later.
Now, just so I'm keeping it clear in my own head and so we can keep it clear for our listeners. When we mention the American Lutheran Publicity Bureau, this begins as a Missouri group.
Yes, yes.
And so while it will eventually become more liberal, and we use that term liberal here, I guess, insofar as one's relation to the traditional confession of the Lutheran Church here, not necessarily what they think about gun control or trickle-down economics.
Right.
But so getting back to the vestments or liturgics in general— So the ALPB, if we're going to play Lutheran acronym games here, begins to push more thoughtful practice when it comes to the worship service, more targeted at the American setting perhaps, but then also the term you use in the paper, which I know you said, someone said maybe wasn't the best term, but I think in our circles most are going to understand what it means. I think it comes out of Anglicanism, but high church or low church, meaning high church is more rooted in vestments, liturgy, things of this nature. Low church, more of a simple service and preaching focused. So the ALPB is going to want to increase the presence of that in Missouri.
Right.
I'm guessing then, well, I'm not guessing because I've read the paper a few times now because I enjoy it. There's going to be voices that say, hey, we don't like that idea, correct?
Well, yeah, and for a variety of reasons. I mean, our pietistic heritage was pretty strong. And when the seminary chapel was dedicated, there was just a book stand up there. And they were just, you know, bare word preaching and none of the liturgical things. President Brenner kind of tipped his hand on a couple of things that he wrote about. We don't need those kind of things in the Wisconsin Synod. Most of our members don't know what they are anyway. But there was a strong encouragement to preach the church year. And that was the encouragement that we got at seminary, too. Preach the church year. And there were pastors I knew who wanted to concoct little 5- and 6-week series all year long. And I was relieved when I was in a church on my own. I did the church year. If there was a series I'd want to do during the Pentecost season or the Trinity season, it'd usually be the Catechism. But then there was also, as there always so often was in the Wisconsin Synod in that era, there was a concern that this was too Catholic and that there was a sense that we were going to become Romanizing. And so you'd see these Romanizing or Romanistic tendencies that the liturgical people were accused of. The liturgical movement was strong at Valparaiso. O.P. Kretzmann was not a great defender, but a supporter, an allower of this. And again, if you looked at the list of the signers of the 44, you'd see a lot of people who had associations. So the American Lutheran Publicity Bureau and this magazine, the American Lutheran, which came out monthly, were subscribed to by something like half the pastors of the synod by the 1940s. But then when the 1938 Convention of Missouri essentially declared that the ALC in Missouri were in agreement on doctrine because the ALC said, well, we accept the brief statement of Missouri according to our understanding of it. Then there was a response action and a group calling itself the Confessional Lutheran Publicity Bureau organized itself, and they had their monthly magazine, The Confessional Lutheran. And so this really demonstrated how what was going on in Missouri was a civil war. And although liturgy was not the main issue of the war, it was a feature of it. And so in Wisconsin, we're in the position of kind of watching this war and cheering for one side. Oscar Naumann said at one point, we've always been on the, you know, found ourselves in agreement with the Confessional Lutheran on these issues. But if you were too interested in liturgy, people might wonder whether you're also buying into other parts of the of that viewpoint. And what the American Lutheran magazine kind of subtly did was that they would print articles written by Lutherans and other synods as though tacitly agreeing with them. You know, we already agree with this. Whereas there are editorialists that, you know, questioned the ELS and questioned Wisconsin. Otto Geisman in River Forest was, I think, clever at this, saying that we probably had some kind of a you know, backward personality, or we've got some, you know, psychological issues maybe, or we never really fully Americanized. And Geiseman always got fresh St. Louis graduates and told them, go to graduate school while you're an assistant pastor. And one of them was Martin Marty. So I think you can see people of a feather that were kind of finding each other. And you talk to them, you listen, well, of course, most of them passed away now, but you listen to them, you read them now. And they got to the point where they felt they were the Missouri Synod. And anybody in Missouri who didn't see issues the way they did weren't really in the Synod.
Now, would you say with that, because that is something interesting to think about, do you think they're thinking that because they think they have numbers or the people in influence in their favor? Or do you think they're thinking that because they think this, they are more connected to the historical practice of the Synod? Or just they're thinking that because they're pretty sure they're right?
Well, I think the feeling that started the ALPB, this sense of we're German outsiders, we're sort of an embarrassment to ourselves, we want to be more accepted in American life, has been a strong influence all the way through. And so, you know, the desire to get terminal degrees and to be recognized by other academic institutions and to be at the table, to be talking about things, you know, like the settlement in Germany and about more ecumenical things, all of that sort of went together. Now, the so-called moderates in Missouri in the 60s and 70s did think they had the numbers. There's a remarkable article in Concordia Theological Monthly in 1969, like about April or May, the Synod Convention was coming, and I want to say that it was, I can't think of the name of who it was, but it was a person recognized in this group, like, I can't remember, there's a couple of names that's escaped, it's not in this paper. But he wrote an article that said basically the vote for fellowship with ALC is coming up this summer, and of course we will all vote for it. And you're really not in the spirit of the Missouri Synod if you don't vote for it. And then when the vote actually occurred, the vote to be in fellowship with the ALC was closer than the vote was in 1961 for Wisconsin to break from Missouri. And, you know, that was the same year that year before that Nixon was elected president. He talked about this silent majority. And I think what happens then in 68 and 69 is that the silent majority of conservatives, whatever that all means, rises up against this. And so, and this is not in this story, this is other stuff.
Sure.
But Jacob Preuss gets elected president of the Synod and feels that this election is his mandate to get down to the bottom of what's happening at Concordia, which was not just liturgical issues, but it was real differences.
And Concordia being the seminary in St. Louis that the Missouri Synod has.
Yeah, yeah. And so finally getting enough authority to put every professor there and essentially going through a heresy trial. And rather than submit to the questions, they went on strike.
And this is, Mark referenced earlier, Seminex is... They call themselves the Seminary in Exile, and I've heard several ELCA theologians or pastors that I'm friends with, when a Missourian is giving them too much of a hard time about their synod, say, well, your synod's the one that gave us the guys who ruined it. So some of these men would go on, and I believe you said A-C-E-L-C?
A-E-L-C.
A-E-L-C, and then that would make their way into the Evangelical Lutheran Church, what becomes the Evangelical Lutheran Church.
Yeah, they first call themselves ELIM, the Evangelical Lutherans in Mission, which you'll notice was also one of the oases that the children of Israel stopped at in the desert of the Sinai Desert, and that's how they saw themselves. They were a voice of freedom in the gospel in the middle of the Sinai Desert. And then Seminary in Exile, which was put together by most of the faculty and most of the students who'd walked off, and that ended up becoming part of the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. And then they formed, and I think it was about 100,000 members that were the AELC. And I don't know, after 1976, I don't know if they were a protesting conference or if they actually were removed from Missouri. But then when the discussions to form the ELCA in the middle 1980s came, they were one of the groups.
And so one of the things that I think is interesting with this as we look at it is we said we're talking about a paper about white gowns in the Wisconsin Synod, and all this stuff is going to be very important. If I can talk a little bit about the work I do with history, it actually comes down to a white robe too. And so right after Luther's death, when there's this adiaphoristic controversy, mm-hmm. there are differences of doctrine that become evident in the Lutheran Church right after Luther's death. And the state tries to mandate wearing a vestment that some Lutherans were already wearing, but that some territories had gotten rid of, which was the surplice. My pastor wears a surplice, so I sometimes needle him a bit because my dissertation is coming out as a book, and the title is The Devil Behind the Surplice. But some Lutherans object to wearing this vestment because the state says you must wear it. And the white gown becomes symbolic for doctrinal shifts that they saw happening within the Lutheran Church already at the end of Luther's life and then after his death. Not changes by Luther, but by some others from Wittenberg. And I think what Mark is getting at and what comes out in the paper is that in our own Synod, in the Wisconsin Synod, as people are watching this play out, and if Peter, if you listen to this, in the show notes, maybe you can put, I think on YouTube there is a, was it CBS or one of the national news networks ran something on Seminex. There's a really interesting, I think it's like a 10-minute video that's available up there. I can try to send the link. But as the Wisconsin Synod is watching this happen, both before Wisconsin Synod broke with the Missouri Synod, and that's another episode, and we've talked about it sometimes with Marka in the past, but even after too, shifts in doctrine come to be associated also with what people are wearing, right? And I think in discussions some of us here have talked about, the clerical collar or more liturgical vestments gets associated with what might be termed liberalism in some synods, where there's been a shift now, and I think Mike and I talked about that when we did the Winging It on clerical collars, to where probably in synodical conference Lutheranism, they're more associated with guys who maybe are trying to have a higher view of the confessions or things of this nature. But Wisconsin's looking at this, and it comes in with its own history. You've mentioned, maybe you can hit a little bit on our beginnings and one of our founding churches and what it said about the liturgy being celebrated. I'm thinking that would be Grace in Milwaukee, if I remember from the paper, and our first Synod president, wouldn't it be?
John Muehlhäuser, who started Grace Church downtown, and who initially didn't even want it to be called a Lutheran church. He wanted to call it Trinity Christian Church. And part of his original constitution of the church said that the order of service of the old Lutheran church shall never be done here. And I think part of this was the pietistic background, that we did not want to be considered Catholic. There was probably some inter-sister squabbling and rivalry that Missouri, Wisconsin sometimes just said, well, look, we're not like Missouri. I think there was a sense that Missouri liked to put on more of a show, like more, see, they tended to see liturgy as a pomp and circumstance kind of thing. It was practical with the traveling preachers that could pull a black gown out of a saddlebag in the horse or whatever and put it on. It wouldn't be dirty looking. And so again, I think I was at seminary in the 1970s, and I think we inherited that as a way to not draw attention to ourselves. We were told wear the black gown because, you know, it doesn't matter what you're wearing. You have nice clothes on, don't have nice clothes on, you're putting a stomach on. The black robe covers that up and draws the attention away from you to the message. But then there was also this completely unding thing that was the white Geneva. And I had a personal fondness for this because my pastor, John Monkey, had a white Geneva that he wore in the summer. And so my mother bought me one, and I had this white Geneva. And I recall taking it along to a pastoral installation in Michigan, in a place I won't name, and with other celebrants I won't name. But he looked at me square in the eye, and he said, I wouldn't trust the theology of any man wearing a white gown. And of course, he said that entirely for my own benefit. And so, you know, we all took black gowns to churches to preach, and that's just what guys wore. And then the big discussion was you must have a white shirt and a very dark tie because it showed through the V-neck. And by the time I got my, I finished my second master's at SEM, and I participated in graduation, I got a call from my advisor and said, be sure to wear your, bring your black gown along. He says, you know, half the guys now don't even buy one. And other than wearing it maybe during Lent or Good Friday, they have no use for it. Now, it had changed that much in that amount of time. And as the paper mentions, a lot of people have kind of gone with it. A whole generation has gone with the change and never knew there was a change. But then there's a pushback from people who either just want to stay in their black gowns or people who want to preach in their sport coat. And they're never quite going to be with it. And then I close by talking about the story of Sibboleth and Shibboleth and Judges, and it means virtually nothing until it becomes a marker for something, mm-hmm. and it puts you on one side or the other. It's more of a social history paper, I think, in some ways. And it's gossipy. I agree. But I was really trying to get more of the perspectives that people had and how really, in some ways, how stubborn those perspectives were. I think there's a point when a lot of us get older where there's only so much more we can change. And then we say, no, this is how I grew up. This is what I learned. And I'm not comfortable.
And I think, you know, that's something that in and of itself is helpful for us to consider because I know when I got to the parish I had served before being here, I had a nice shut-in who had been a shut-in for quite some time, and one of her relatives or someone must have been in my ordination and shared a picture of it, and I had been in the alb, and that everybody else except I think two pastors were in an alb too. And I remember when I went to visit her, you know, she kind of was upset or bothered that I was wearing the white robe. And, you know, so, well, what would Luther think about that? And I wasn't going to get in an argument about robes. But I went back and I looked in the pictures in the back of church, and my predecessor had been wearing a white robe for quite some time. But obviously we weren't wearing our robes on shut-in calls. And for her, what the pastor was wearing was associated with the message she heard from the pastor. And so I think with a number of things, this can be quite understandable that people will associate a vestment with a message. You know, in many ways, ceremony is doctrine for the eyes. People associate what they see with the message they've heard. And so it's interesting going through your paper, Mark, to see the different things that people have connected with this in the past. I think my favorite line in there, you know, Mark is doing oral history, and so there's a number of surveys he's gotten from this, and he does a very good job with that. But one person, I can't remember if it was a pastor or professor, who commented, you know, those who can't preach the white robe wear it. And the impression I got as I read the paper too is that it was assumed that if someone was more liturgical in the, you know, the Western Rite sense, or wanted a more frequent celebration of the Lord's Supper, that it was assumed, and maybe it was true too, that the sermon became less of an emphasis or less important, many thought, in the view.
Well, yeah. Okay. So that two things. I think there were three reasons that Wisconsin people, and I would include members even more so than pastors, warmed to this slowly. One was a sense that this was too Catholic. And, you know, I came out of school at a time where any idea could be killed in a congregation if somebody said, too Catholic. The second thing was that this came to be associated with the things in Missouri that were happening that scared us. What was happening to them? And then third one, there's a good comment by one of the respondents who said the first time he wore his, it wasn't just an alb. It had the collar, kind of like Queen Elizabeth, you know. And it had, and she just looked at him and says, gaudy, gaudy, gaudy. Like you're drawing too much attention to yourself. The black Geneva was understood to be the epitome of humility in the sense of, don't look at me. And, you know, it covers me up. But then, what was it that you just said that got on the other point about?
That I think it seems like some of the respondents had a concern that those who were advocating for more high church practices, if we can use that term, were also either downplaying the importance of the sermon or the sermon was becoming a less emphasized aspect of the divine service.
Yeah, and I heard that from survey respondents. You've only got an hour. And a lot of pastors I knew work very...
Which is Galatians 3:4, right? That you only have an hour, I believe, is where
Paul
says.
Well, no one saved after 20 minutes, yeah. So they'd work hard on that sermon. I was in a congregation where the live feed from the church service came on the local radio station at 9 o'clock, just like that. So what they tried to do was make sure the sermon was within that half hour from 9 to 9:30, the whole sermon. And so we started 8:45 and diddled with the liturgy so that it would all fit. And there are members who said to me, well, you know, that's the only important part of the service anyway. Now, that was not a good way to look at this. And when a sermon wasn't particularly filled with gospel, you could be hopeful that the liturgy or the hymns would at least talk about Jesus. But there was a fear that there'd be a sort of a pendulum flip-flop, that people are very concerned about liturgy. And, you know, they're saying, well, now today we're introducing this wonderful thing from the Irish church in the 14th century. And then the sermon seemed to be little more than an introduction to the reading, or perhaps just an observation. You know. And again, that sounded Catholic. You know, you go to a Catholic Mass and the sermon is not the highlight of the service very often. And so I understood their fears. And one of the most effective articles that Professor Tiefel wrote, I think he had a clear idea of the change he hoped that would come about. And the article was called, "But That's Catholic, Isn't It?" And his answers to this, and one of his answers were, "No, it's not Catholic, it's Christian." And we had to get used to that sense that what we had come to think of as a sectarian sort of divisive thing actually had roots much farther back. And people began to buy into it. And his concern, if I understand him correctly, was he was concerned about young pastors trying to bring the whole change in liturgics on congregations that weren't ready for it. And that was a pastorally unfortunate decision to make.
And I feel like I keep cutting off mic, so I'll be very short and sweet here. I think that's something that is an important and a valuable insight, too, because I'll admit, I think the first time I read this, I had just got to WLC, and it came up in conversation, and it was something you had shared with me, is someone having come from the outside, so I became Lutheran in 95, and Wells in 95, which was right after the new hymnal had come out, and not being as aware of what the practice of the church had been for most of its history, is that sometimes I can look at things going on in the, not only just in our church body, but in Lutheranism in general, but focusing on our church body and say, oh man, we should be, what about this from the liturgy and that from the liturgy? And I mean, anybody who knows me kind of knows where my inclinations fall with a lot of this. It's not hidden very well. I tend to appreciate the Western Rite. But reading this really opened my eyes to the, not, I don't know if seismic is the right word, but very, you know, in church history, 50 years, 40 years, 30 years is a blip on the map.
Yeah.
A rather significant shift that had taken place, so that probably most of the men you're talking about in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, if they looked at Christian worship today or whatever gets produced by the hymnal committee that's coming out next, some might be surprised and some might be a little bit hot under the, I'd say under the collar, but under their tie or the Geneva about what they've seen developing.
They would be uncomfortable, yeah. I think one of the things that Professor Tiefel's colleagues emphasized to me was that he never advocated or introduced any changes without bringing them along with him. You know, are you guys ready for this? So that it wasn't just him wearing the alb, it was other faculty. It was the Christmas concert, and, you know, even the most conservative of the faculty, the older ones, would be wearing this. I had an incident that I mentioned which was not quite like this at Watertown, and the music director told me about this, that for Reformation Day, they had a single trumpeter accompany the melody of A Mighty Fortress with the congregation, and the former president at Northwestern came out furious and said to him, "I don't come to chapel to see a show." Now, that's a very tame kind of addition to the worship by our measure.
Sure. Unless the trumpeter was dancing or something.
No, he was out of sight.
Ah.
Yeah, going back to that idea of, you know, it's too Catholic, and throwing that phrase around without really backing it up with any historical preference or perspective, I think is important. We talk about the narrow Lutheran middle road theologically, but if you want to think about it when it comes to liturgics, you know, the left-hand side of the road would be, you know, the more radical Reformation, and then the right side of the road would be the Roman Catholic side, and I think it's foggy out there, and sometimes we're way on the left, and we look at the center, which may be historically Christian, historically Lutheran, and we think it's Roman Catholic, but really it's not, and it's from our perspective, we just can't kind of see. And then if you want to get people to the center of the road, you can't just yank them. It's a slow merging onto the center. And so, you know, like you said, like a trumpet's not Catholic. Holy Communion's not Catholic, you know? And it just takes a while to get people, and it takes some patience to get people to see all those things.
Well, and there are some people that just don't like to feel that they're lab rats. You know, oddly enough, C.S. Lewis said some things that would probably relate to this. He said, The command is feed my sheep, don't teach my dogs new tricks. And he even said about the liturgy, he'd have been talking about the liturgy of the Anglican Church, he says, the best liturgy is one you don't have to consciously think about. Now, we might say, yeah, we've already got too much of that problem of people not consciously thinking about worship. But, you know, when you're concerned, overly concerned about what innovation is being done on me this week, there was that concern. I think people from a pastoral perspective felt that they were being experimented on too much, and we tried to avoid that. There were pastors who felt they couldn't do those things. They were used to this kind of a common way of doing things.
And that comes out in the paper, too. There wasn't a lot of training in these things that was happening for many pastors of a certain age going through. You talk about how a worship course or discussion of this starts to develop at seminary. But, you know, a lot of people, yeah, I would assume looking at this, this is not something they were trained to do. Sorry to interrupt, but...
No, that's true. And, I mean, not to think less of the course, but probably it was true that the one liturgical hour of the day, which all the classes went to, was probably tolerated by most of the student body. I mean, you'd have a few people that ask really deep questions about, I hear they're doing this to the Gloria Patri or something. And most of us are, it didn't register. And I think that was kind of a rude thing on our part and a lack of comprehension for what would be going on.
Seminarians being rude?
Yeah, that's hard to
imagine.
That
must have changed by the time Mike and I got there.
Hard to imagine, wasn't it, that all-boy kind of culture. Admittedly, the pastors that responded to this were speaking their own biases or prejudices, but they also spoke their experiences, mm-hmm. and it wasn't the same every place. And there were some pastors who had the alb and the vestments and emphasized the church here decades before this became popular, but they were trusted for other reasons. They were steady pastors. They had good judgment. They didn't give any indication that they were not to be trusted. So this wasn't a signal for them. But you know, we really do operate a lot on signals and cultural markers like that.
And I think when people are holding to these things, you know, as I have kind of mentioned, it's not always the thing they're holding to, but there's more wrapped up in this in their own mind.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's we might look at something and say, well, why do you, you know, you look at churches that have candles on the altar and different churches light them in different orders or different ways. And you might have someone who notices, okay, they lit it a different way, and this very much concerns them. End of the day, they're not necessarily so much concerned about the candles as what this whole normal Sunday experience has come to represent for them, which in many ways can be a good thing if it's the message of Christ.
There was a man I know, I didn't tell the story in the paper, a man I know who went to the dedication of the seminary library in 1968. And one of the members of the board came with a collar, and I think he wore a surplice among all the other kind of black crows there, you know. And this lay member who saw this said he's wearing the uniform of the enemy. And he says, you know, in World War II, if you showed up in the other camp with the uniform of the enemy, you were shot. Now, it helps to know that this man's history was that he had an unhappy marriage to a Catholic woman for 20 years, and he thinks that a lot of the difficulties that were there had a reflection from her Catholic connection with her priest and so on. So he's coming from a specific place,
yep.
too. Now, was this board member simply doing what he does everywhere else? Could he have given a highly helpful historical lecture about what the collar means in the Lutheran Church? Even if he could have, would he have convinced many people? I can't believe he did it for shock value. Did he do it because he wanted to be progressive and kind of lead the rest of them into it? And did he go farther than some people were willing to go? See, I don't know.
Right.
You know, we always had that general advice of don't be the first to initiate a custom or the last to get rid of one. Well, that's sometimes a little hard to do.
Well, and I think, you know, there is a danger as one who, you know, came out of seminary, not because of seminary, but because I was already there, kind of raring to go with an appreciation for the liturgy and things of this nature. As I, you know, meet young pastors from various synods, it's not necessarily a healthy thing to have the most excited thing you're most excited about on graduation day be your new clothes. You know, it's good to go in to be a preacher of the gospel and then get to know your congregation and see where they're at. And so I think you're absolutely right that there can be you know, why is this person doing this at this point? And there can be a danger if it's shock value or I'm going to wear this now to promote something. You're not leading people along in the healthiest way.
Well, and I even point out that there were a few instances in which wearing black garb and being unconcerned about it, except it covered you up. I mean, I knew pastors who had a rip in their hem of their garb, a gown, and they would just have it taped up with duct tape on the inside. There was sort of a manliness about them, and so there was also sometimes an attack of being effeminate or maybe even, you know, sort of gay. That snuck out in a few of their comments, that this was kind of, you know, there would be comments about there they are swishing around in their robes. Now, of course, that's a whole different kind of a cultural context than we have to deal with today.
Sure.
But see, all those things were there, and they didn't have to be spoken after a while. They were understood. So real men do X. And one was you wear a black gown, but you don't stand looking at yourself in the mirror in it a lot, you know. So when guys started going to gas bars and started, you know, looking at the colors and saying, isn't this cool, saying, what's going on here? what's changed?
I just have a quick question, and I probably from my own experience, and I don't have any data on this or anything, but I've been a member of several different churches growing up as we moved around, and in asking my pastors about vestments or being taught about it at the grade schools, whenever the Geneva, the Black Geneva was talked about, it was that, well, it's because the focus shouldn't be on the man itself. It should be on, you know, the word being preached. And then when people were justifying, you know, the alb or whatever, they would say, the reason we wear white is it because it represents holiness, and the pastor is speaking in the stead of he's bringing God's word to the people. So I guess, do you think there's any element of the view of the pastoral office that gets into this discussion, or is it? Did your research not really take you in that direction?
No. I find when I talk with Missouri pastors, they're liable to see any issue I talk about as needing to be viewed through the lens of the doctrine of the ministry. So, you know, that kind of goes on. I think another thing that was said, which was actually kind of confusing, was that an argument in favor of the alb was that it was the historical clothing worn in the service, and the Geneva was more what the academic wore.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, that would really argue. Of course, even the name Geneva ought to have scared some of us away.
That's true.
Because that really comes from the classroom instead of from the liturgical history. There was just a sense we shouldn't be full of ourselves, and that's what I would hear. That you know, people are so easily distractible, and I certainly had a dose of that again being in church today. You sit in the back a couple of weeks and you wonder how anybody's saved with all the stuff that's going on. You know, the pastor looks like he's putting on his weight, or where did he get that tie from, or he must have spilled his breakfast. See, the robe covered it all up. Now, we weren't talking about the robe of Christ, you know, the righteousness of Christ being white. We were just saying it covered it up.
Sure.
Well, what was odd was having one guy helping with communion with black and the other with white. You know, there was kind of a sin and grace thing going on. Now, one of the pastors in the comments why the changes came said that color television and willingness to have more color in our church, like with vestments and banners and things, opened the door to have more color, have the white looked more cheerful. And you can make the argument it represents the resurrection. But they're all kind of arguments that are made not really as reasons but as justifications. They're kind of stuck onto the end of it.
Yeah, there's a great part towards the end of the paper that survey respondents give their reasons why they moved. And some of them, it has nothing to do with what you think they had any kind of, you know, stuff like somebody gave it to me or my daughter asked me to try it or something, you know.
But, you know, behind those apparently, you know, very, you know, almost meaningless things, really small things, is the sense, I think, that the service, the expectations are changing. These things mean something different. It's okay to do this now. You know, maybe a pastor who wasn't so sure that this was the right thing to do, but he says to his buddies, well, you know, my daughter bought it for me, you know, so I thought I would do this to please her. Now, that wouldn't have convinced anybody 20 years before that, but by now it was okay.
Yeah, I appreciate what struck me about the paper is literally a 180 almost in a lot of these people's minds that this is not the first time I've heard it, but I was surprised how strong the opinion was, well, the black robe covers up the man, it's not about him. To me, I think the exact opposite. I think a 45-minute sermon full of stories about your last vacation is about you, where if you're more serious about the liturgy and stuff, you're drawing your attention away from the stuff. And both of those are more perceptions and opinions, but just how 180 it can be and can change. For instance, you talked about being in an ordination, bringing your white robe. I was at an ordination, well, maybe 5-6 years ago, and it was me making the snarky comment. We had two guys in black robes, and I said, just for picture's sake afterwards, you know, we'll frame the picture with the two Reform guys on the outside and the Lutherans in the middle. Just how, you know, we can, and it was all in fun, but how quickly, like you said, Wade, in the history of the church, just like that, it could switch 180.
Yeah, mine wasn't entirely in good fun, I would say. maybe two-thirds at best, but you know, there's what else are you thinking that's not entirely on the level because you're wearing this white gown? It does show how, I think, how really strongly people can feel about something which is in and of itself not a thing. And so now we have somewhat of a comparable thing going on with how strongly people feel about a preacher who's wearing jeans with strategic cuts in them and an open collared shirt, and how different the message is if you walk away from the pulpit instead of stay behind it. These are such external things.
And I think one of the interesting things with that, that it gets at is when the changes are taking place, when we ask, well, why are they taking place? And that becomes the point where we really owe a debt of gratitude and love to listen. Because sometimes we will say, well, why are you changing something? And maybe someone was going to the alb and stoles because they wanted to align themselves more with a mainstream, more Jesus is Lord and we won't talk about much more type Christianity. But others may well have been doing so simply because maybe they thought it was more historical or because maybe they thought it aided the sharing of the message of Christ and Word and Sacrament. And I think in our own day, too, I was in class the other day. I was talking to my students about just the internet. You know, it used to be that I could get upset about stuff that happened in my actual life. So maybe I had a buddy who said something stupid, and then I could get riled up about that. But now I'm just exposed to people around the globe who are able to rile me up. And so when we do see shifts, investments or not wearing vestments in our own day, too, I think there are times where we might ask someone and they would say, well, because we want to be more like this or that. I know one young pastor who was told by an older pastor, he was founding a mission church, and he was told, go see what the Pentecostal street church is doing down the street and do that because they're growing. And I would say, well, imitating that might be problematic if we're maybe bringing in things that developed in a context of a confession that would not be ours. But there also might be people who are you know, making specific changes because they do think it more clearly confesses Christ. And so if you've listened and you've gotten this far, if you've got riled up or you thought right on with anything, that's maybe a good question to ask ourselves is why are we falling while we're falling with that? And I don't want to get too hard on the bully pulpit with that, but, you know, I find in my own life sometimes there's less heat and light when we get to the why. Mike and I did a winging in on clerical collars not too long ago. And didn't get a single person upset writing in, but did get a few who reached out and said, you know, I still am not necessarily a fan of them, but I really kind of understand why you do it. And I think that maybe is something that has developed, too, as the Synod has made moves towards a more historic liturgy, but something that can be gleaned in our own time, too, is if brothers are doing something different to be able to take that step, why?
Well, and if I can tell you a local story on this, I've been here 30 years, and as far back as I go, I have bumped into people, or they've bumped into me here, who said to me, is it true that you still have Catholic priests come on campus to do chapel? And they really have heard this, and I guess their view is, I've heard it enough times that it must be true. And so I've said,
Mike, I told them not to let you do chapel.
Just follow this through. I said, there have never been Catholic priests in my time. My first job here when I first got here was to schedule chapel. I never scheduled a priest to do chapel. And I never had anybody tell me I was forsaking some kind of practice by not having them anymore. And, you know, sometimes I would get the answer, well, that's not what I heard. And then there really was no place for conversation. But there are several people who still work here today who, if I would tell them that, I have told them that, and they've said to me, well, that's because some of us wear collars on campus. And they're doing it in front of students that don't understand this, and they're wondering, is he Catholic? Now, you can judge for yourself whether that's something to be avoided or something to be encouraged or needs to be explained. Will some people keep believing something no matter what you tell them?
Sure. The problem I encountered is when I would wear shirt and tie in class, people kept trying to buy cars from me. I'm just joking. But no, I don't doubt that could easily play in. And it shows, what people can associate things with. And I know, Mike, you had mentioned in that Winging It session, a student asking you who was, if I'm not mistaken, was a Marine. And, you know, a good conversation coming out of that. But it coming out of the asking of why. And one thing I've found in my own experience now is the people I most appreciate their ministry and the people that I feel closest to at the end of the day in the synod tend to be those that at the end of the day are about law and gospel. And yeah. So, you know, you and I, Mark, might not necessarily have all the same experience or preferences when it comes to how we conduct the liturgy. But when Mark is preaching chapel, I know what I'm going to get. And I'd much rather that than someone who maybe dresses and does everything I would have them do, but doesn't get to Christ and my need for him.
Well, I appreciate that. And I would, this is why if when you think we're done here, I'd like to read this last paragraph and a half, because I think it does kind of bring it together. But I don't want to cut anybody off.
Sure. Mike, I feel like I cut you off a couple times. Anything else you wanted to bring out in connection with this?
Well, maybe just one comment. As I teach the worship class here on campus, one of the big points that I make is when you look at the history of the church and why certain denominations do this and don't do that, you see that it fits well with two things. One is their theology, and the other one is the philosophy of the day. And for us to try to raise ourselves above that as best we can, not above it as in we're better than it, but say, okay, this period, this time, this denomination is doing this, and ask yourself why. And then ask yourself, why do we do these things in this certain time, in this certain place? And have a historical perspective of mm-hmm. all of this is mm-hmm. just so very important, because if you don't, then you start saying this is Catholic or this is Reformed or this is Evangelical or this is Pentecostal, and you end up, if you don't have facts behind your opinions, then you got to back it up with something, and that's the heat and the light.
Yeah.
And where sometimes these comical explanations for why
sure.
we do what we do will come in. And,
sure.
Maybe, you know, and I think you're onto this too, Mike, when you read the paper, I think the one author even says this has been the practice for the last century. Those who do Lutheran history, you know, well, I do into Luther's time and then leading up to basically the Formula of Concord, it's kind of interesting to see how even Missouri's experience coming over versus Wisconsin's, you know, how much the Prussian Union and the influence of the state church and reform things play in, so that what is the norm, you could actually have quite a big discussion on how it came to be,
mm-hmm.
but the importance of the norm, what it happens. And so, you know, when I've had discussions, oftentimes I will say, well, let's jump to this period, to that period, to this period. Just because Wittenberg in 1553 or whatever was doing a certain thing is not a reason we should do it necessarily. But I think, as Mike is pointing out, that should be something that's held up as a next to how somebody in Wisconsin is doing something in 1933, where we can say, how did this come about? What was it serving to do? How does it either connect or differentiate from the broader church? Sometimes we want to do one or the other, right?
Mm-hmm,
And so I think there's a couple episodes in and of themselves, or maybe Winging It's, on maybe the parts of the historic liturgy and how they've been used or not used and things like that. But I think we see in play how much we are a child of our environment. And I mean, coming out of Roman Catholicism, I sometimes joked with my members when they, if some would be a little concerned about someone donating a processional crucifix, for instance, that not too many were too concerned, but, you know, I would just in good fun joke, you know, well, I might be a papal spy sent to, you know, turn the Wells Catholic, you know, one by one. But I would be the first to admit I had a particular experience with my worship life growing up, and I'm sure that my appreciation for many of the historic practices of the Church Catholic was shaped by that. I would also say probably you're not going to find a guy who's going to be more bothered by truly Roman Catholic practices than me. I sometimes joke with people, and you can say that what I think is Catholic all you want, but I'm the guy that Catholic Church is actually sending to hell because I chose to leave knowing the doctrine. And so if someone were to say, well, I want to do the canon of the Mass, the first guy grabbing a pitchfork is going to be right here. But we all grow up in an environment or in a day, and I think, Mike, you're with your students, that's a very important thing that you are drawing out to them as well.
And to be truly open-minded is to know the past. If you only see, if you're only rebelling against the last 20 years or whatever, well, you know, you got to have a wider, not to have a chronological snobbery, right? And say, you know, I'm not just rebelling against my parents or whatever, but let's take a step back and look at it all here. And you'll learn something about yourself, and you'll learn something about the church, and you're better apt to make a good decision. So,
Before Mark reads his last page, I have one quote I want to read just because I love it. And I think it expresses well some of the views of the Wisconsin in the past is August Pieper. You have in here, and I had heard this before, but wir sind in der Wisconsin Synod, wir machen kein Show. We are in the Wisconsin Synod. We make no show, right? And so we are Let the Bird Fly, and we do make a show. And so hopefully you've gotten something out of that. But as we thank Mark for coming on again, and there's listener response is just always great to him coming on, and we appreciate him being willing to do so. Why don't we let you, Mark, anything you want to share with us or read or as you bring it down, we'll let you do. And then don't forget, at the end, we're going to ask you to finish with a certain phrase if we can remember it this time. So
well, I'm working on that.
All right. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, at the end of the paper, I talked about this history of the Sibboleth event in the Book of Judges. And I said, Armin Schitzy noted in a 1978 Wisconsin Lutheran Quarterly art forward that from this incident has come the term shibboleth as, quote, a criterion, test, or watchword of something, a word or saying distinguishing the adherents of a party or sect. Professor Schitzy cited several examples of theological shibboleths from the Reformation era and in the current theological climate. The manducatio impiorum, the eating of the body and blood of Christ even by unbelievers, the six-day creation, the historicity of the Book of Jonah, and others. Shibboleths, he wrote, may have no profound meaning in and of themselves and may seem unimportant, yet what they reveal may be of great consequence. For most of the history of the Wisconsin Synod, wearing a black Geneva gown and exhibiting limited enthusiasm for many elements of liturgical worship served as a paradigm and a shibboleth to assure that a man was doctrinally and culturally acceptable among the synodical's ministerium. In the last two decades, the paradigm has shifted and the shibboleth no longer holds. What many once viewed as a reliable indicator of orthodoxy and trustworthiness no longer carries that meaning. Wearing the black Geneva may have led some pastors to believe they could trust their neighboring clergymen, but not wearing it may have put many more men's ministries under a cloud of suspicion they never deserved. And the men and women sitting in our pews probably care much, much more about seeing genuine piety in the life and work of their pastors than about whether it comes in black or white. And I was thinking a little bit about, I just couldn't do it, but you know, that was about the time when Michael Jackson's song, Ain't No Difference If You're Black and White, was popular. I just couldn't do that.
I think that closes us out, though, on a very helpful reminder of how we approach these things and how we look at them and how we consider those whose practice may be a little bit different than ours. And I think there's probably 3, 4, 5 episodes that could come out of this. I know we want to get Dr. Brown on if we can convince him on Deuteronomy here sometime, too.
Sure.
He's got some fun thoughts on that. Before I run our closing line here by Mark, Ben or Mike, anything else before we send ourselves out? All right. Well, so as we look at the liturgical life of the churches around us in our own synod or the church bodies as a whole, what pastors are wearing or what the congregation is saying, when it boils down to it, as we live freely in Christ and the world given back to us, Dr. Brown, what's the one thing we can do?
Let the bird fly.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get with my party and I begin to cry. I don't care what the people are thinking, I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set them up another round, I'll set them up another round, I'll set them up another round. One more round won't get me down. I said, honey, I don't care what the people are thinking.